Michael McCusker. And happy Halloween, a giddy parodying of evil on All Saints' Eve to cleanse the spirit for All Saints' Day tomorrow. Or so that is the script or myth which children parlayed as their own holiday as the centuries grew less spiritually superstitious. Yet adults have been stealing it back with revels and parties like the venerated ancestors, which relegates the children in all their monster and ghostly apparel to mass mobbing of downtown merchants in every town USA after school and then off to babysitters when they used to trick-or-treat the neighbors while their parents frolic like devilish pubescents. The Grinch stole Christmas. The grown-ups repossess Halloween. In the meantime, while all those miniature demons, gargoyles, and goblins who represent the purge of evil maraud and candy sack city centers, a ghostly image of top hats and high building ledges fades into legend and nervous extrinsicality. Yet the specter remains this year's 90th anniversary of Black Tuesday 1929, when the American stock market crashed the lowest ever, and the jazz age of the 1920s went off a ledge, bankrupt and depressed. The whole thing is black comedy, aside from the undaunted myth that a generation of bankrupt bankers, financiers, and mega millionaires leaped off tall buildings with empty pockets. 9/11 and the 1911 shirtwaist fire in New York City come to mind. 2 days before the annual Halloween monster bash, the spiritual is as usually upstaged by money madness, which continues to literally despoil the earth and intrude its primacy into human affairs, including the spiritual spectrum which Halloween seems to represent. The stock market crash of 1929 was not a slight affair, the late economist John Kenneth Galbraith wrote in his continually pertinent book, The Great Crash, 1929. Black Tuesday combined all the bad features of all the bad days before and was the most devastating day in the history of markets, Galbraith wrote. Halloween is all about crashing pumpkins. One in particular is the apex of horror, conjured by the estimable Knickerbocker Washington Irving, who also wrote A History of Astoria, Oregon in 1836, and two other books of the early American Far West. As he wrote in perhaps his most famous story, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, the schoolmaster of Sleepy Hollow, perhaps the most memorable as well as most unlikely character in American literature, Ichabod Crane, is pursued at, quote, the very witching hour of night, quote, unquote, by a sinister headless horseman on a huge black stallion. The horseman's head was mounted on the pommel of his saddle. After a wild chase, Ichabod Crane thought he was safe. Just then, he saw the headless horseman rising in his stirrups, Washington Irving wrote, and in the very act of hurling his head at him, the horrible missile encountered Ichabod Crane's cranium with a tremendous crash. He was tumbled headlong into the dust. The black steed and the headless rider passed like a whirlwind, Irene wrote. All that was found of the hapless schoolmaster was his hat, and, quote, close beside it, a shattered pumpkin. So hold your thoughts of Sleepy Hollow this All Hallows Eve, and cease a moment before you hum or whistle Modeste Mussorgsky's Night on Bald Mountain. As I begin today's program with an ode to Halloween by Oregon's longtime unofficial poet laureate, Walt Curtis, which he wrote many tricks and treats ago. Halloween by Walt Curtis. Why is Halloween my favorite holiday? Holy Day. The Oxford English Dictionary says All Hallows' Eve originally was the last day in the old Celtic calendar. In the 8th century, the clever Christian church established All Saints' Day on November 1st to co-opt the pagan festival. But the Druid imagery of black cats, cornstalks, evil spirits, and pumpkins survived and triumphed. Children love it. They can dress up as ghosts, witches, and hobgoblins and scare themselves and their friends. Each house they go to will give them a treat, candy, cookie, or apple. If the neighbors don't placate the little gremlins, a trick or prank might be played on them, waxing the windows, or years ago when the outdoor privy was in vogue, our family had to watch that it wasn't toppled into a crick. Because all poets are grown-up children, I enjoy Halloween as an opportunity to relive childhood. I once put on lipstick and wore a ghost costume under the shining moon, afraid to walk for fear of my own shadow. However, there is more to it than that. Halloween is replete with associations which only an adult can really fathom and appreciate. Harvest time, the guilt-laden Freudian fear of the dead, sense of one's own fragile mortality, the dramatic aesthetics of autumn, and the existential realization that our bodies will become compost. I would like to share some poetic notions from past Halloweens. The first has to do with driving to Sauvie Island, a rural farmscape within 10 miles of urban Portland, Oregon. There, I picked my own pumpkin, lying in a field with its peers. This particular farm is called the Pumpkin Patch. Each year, my sensibility goes absolutely mad, psychedelicized at what I see. Pumpkins, more and more pumpkins, in wooden crates, hiding beneath the wheels of tractors and between the discs of machinery, ready to be sliced back into the soil. A beat-up international truck of World War II vintage contains a bedful of sons, muddy from the fields. In an aluminum shed, the farmer serenely peddles brilliant orange noggins. I swear this large man, wearing a safari hat with leopard skin band, is dressed in hunting togs. The huge Hubbard squash look like bagged game. Stalking the great green warty gourd, it is a wonder it doesn't roll over on you or drop from the sky and crush your brains. Meanwhile, tiny human beings growing also, children, wander from the field with golden orbs in their arms. It is a day glow dream. Pumpkins rest in shopping carts, small carved ones stacked upon bigger ones, babies, families of pumpkins, pumpkins with mustaches, lips smiling in black ink. They mock our existence. Merely by their presence, these round, blank-faced Buddhas proclaim our lives evanescent. Shouldn't we roll and wrestle in the harvest fruit, juice of apples, pulp of squash and pumpkin? In late October, revel in the dying light, shoot Polaroid color snapshots. A naked boy or girl with a pumpkin head sprawls, the green umbilical cord raveling along the ground until it roots. Or the other image, in the distance, a woman is naked with an umbilical cord leading to a yellow close-up pumpkin. I am not being sacrilegious. We come from the earth, and we must return. I ask myself, what is a pumpkin? It is earth, but it is more than that. A pumpkin is sun, also, in the shape of a plant harvested at the end of a cycle. Energy manifest and food. The sun goes down to be reborn from the ground. The only true gold is squash, sweet corn, pumpkins, russet potatoes, and all vegetables. False is the metal, fool's gold, fit to be laughed at. Ha, ha, he, he. For the last 8 years, establishing a cheerful tradition, I have taken my Sauvy Island pumpkin to a dear friend's house of Margaret, the piano teacher and composer. With her children and invited guests, we creatively carved the golden gourds, scooping out edible seeds and spun orange guts onto newspapers, cutting triangular noses and toothy grins. When all have finished, we line our pumpkin cells up on the mantle and turn out the electric lights. We quietly watch their candle eyes flicker, staring into our own. It is a charming resurrection and pleasing exorcism, not meant to terrify the neighbor's children, nor are we driving away demon spirits, witches, and ghosts. We don't believe in those things. What is all this carving of golden heads really about? Try it for yourself this Halloween and find out. Place a glimmering candle in the center of your being and feel fire beams of fear radiate in the black with a smile in every direction. Spook you. Halloween is a happy time. And that was Halloween by Walt Curtis. Oregon's long-lasting, unofficial poet laureate. And now, by Iris Wild, Burning Witches, starts with a poem by Robin Moore. Repeat the syllables before the lesson perforates the uterus. Anna Rausch, burned, 1628, 12 years old. Sybil Lutz, burned, 1628, 11 years old. Emira Zian Pichler, tortured and burned together with her two young children, 1679. Agnes Wobster, drowned while her small son was forced to watch her trial by water, 1567. Annabelle Stewart, burned alive, 1678, 14 years old. Veronica Zerich, compelled to dance in the warm ashes of her executed mother, then burned alive herself, 1754, 13 years old. Frau Dummler, boiled to death in hot oil while pregnant, 1630. What have they done? And that was by Robin Morgan. And by Iris Wild, with a quote from Glinda of Oz, "Are you a good witch or a bad witch?" Every Halloween we are besieged with images of the bad witch, old, warty, toothless hags with black, pointy hats, black cats, broomsticks, and steaming cauldrons in which they cook children and puppies. They cast terrible spells and foretell doom and the murders of kings. Cackling and bent, they shriek out of every fairy tale. The myth of the bad witch is an excellent example of how our knowledge and understanding of women's history has been distorted. From earliest times, women have been witches. Witchcraft, or Wicci, the craft of the wise, was a pagan religion of Europe for centuries prior to the rise of Christianity, and was the folk religion of the peasantry for hundreds of years after Catholicism prevailed among the ruling classes of the West. The old religion of witchcraft was an earth-centered, nature-oriented worship that venerated the goddess, the source of life, as well as her lover consort, the horned god of animal life and of the hunt. The basic orientation of this religion was to the earth, to life, to nature, with no dichotomy between spirit and flesh, no split between Godhead and the world. Sexuality, fertility, and nature were celebrated. The magic of the witches was an imposing catalog of medical skills and sophisticated knowledge of telepathy, auto and heterosuggestion, hypnotism, and mood-controlling drugs. The witches knew the medicinal nature of herbs and developed the science of organic medicine before there was a medical profession. Paracelsus, the most famous physician of the Middle Ages, claimed that everything he knew he had learned from, quote, the good women, unquote. As Christianity spread across Europe, it attempted to convert the witches, a stubborn seesaw persistence that lasted for centuries, and which left evidence of an increasing mixing of the separate beliefs. Christianity prevailed, and the horned, cloven-hoofed pagan god was changed into the image of Satan. In the 13th century, the church began a 300-year persecution of witches that would take the lives of an estimated 9 million persons, 80% of whom were women. The torture and murder were extensive. Some villages, after a witch trial, were left with only one living woman. In one province, 400 women were put to death as witches in a single day. Many of those tortured and killed did not practice witchcraft. Any woman suspected to be independent and free-thinking was put on trial. The church enforced the curse of Eve, quote-unquote, Genesis chapter 3, by refusing to permit any alleviation of the pain of childbirth. To be a midwife was to risk the stake and fire. An acquaintance with herbs soothing to pain or healing was looked upon as having been acquired through diabolical agency. Here, to be noted, Jews and heretical thinkers were persecuted also. The use of the term faggot to describe homosexuals had its origin in the persecution of witches. When a woman was to be burned as a witch, men accused of homosexuality were bound and mixed with the bundles of kindling, faggots, at the feet of the witch and set on fire, quote, to kindle a flame foul for a witch to burn in, unquote. The chief document used to suppress witchcraft, Cramer and Sprenger's Malleus Maleficarum, commissioned by the Pope in 1486, discusses the evil nature of women at length. According to this document, the main reason for women's frequent alliance with evil is that, quote, she is more carnal than a man, as is clear from her many carnal abominations. There was a defect in the formation of the first woman, since she was formed from a bent rib, and since through this defect she is an imperfect animal, she always deceives. To conclude, all witchcraft comes from carnal lust, which is in woman insatiable, quote, unquote. The Malleus also asserts that women are intellectually like children, have weak memories, are liars by nature, and by nature are instruments of Satan. Anyone would be hard put to come up with a document more frenzied in its woman-hating or so destructive. The Malleus was in every courtroom and read by every judge. To disregard it, to challenge its authority, was to commit heresy, a capital crime. And so, some 9 million lost their lives. Today, women are reclaiming the word witch, and with it some of their lost culture. The feminist movement, which began as a political, economic, and social struggle, is opening to a spiritual dimension. More women are beginning to turn away from the image of God the Father and the sexist teachings inherent in the patriarchal church, and are searching for spiritual fulfillment by investigating the female principle of the universe. Many women are becoming more aware of the moon as a female symbol and how its cycles of waxing and waning coincide with their menstrual cycles and mental states. Women are choosing to celebrate full moons, solstices, and equinoxes like the witches of old, and are finding the divine within themselves and the natural world. Midwives and natural healers are reviving the ancient arts, and while they no longer fear the flames, they have faced persecution from the established medical profession. It is important for women and men to be aware of how the persecution of witches and the annihilation of an ancient religion has affected women's position today. The heritage, the culture, the knowledge of the ancient priestesses, healers, poets, singers, and seers were nearly lost, but seeds survived the flames that will blossom in a new age into thousands of flowers. Iris Wilde used to be a Cannon Beach waitress. Her real name is Deborah Cooper. And she is living in San Francisco and was an original member of the Clatsop County Women's Crisis Service. And now, after a war is lost, nach einem verlorenen Krieg, written by George Kaiser and translated by Astoria's own Kevin Violet. After a war is lost, when starvation and degradation rule and all values are sold down the river, a bunco artist sees his chance. He senses, because he is himself filled with basic instincts, that he can rule everyone if he promises them a way out of the hopeless situation. And so he promises the moon if they will follow and obey. And this folk that has lost everything and sees no way out believes in its dullness his empty rant, which bespeaks not the good of the many, but only his own lust to power, to rule. At first the number of believers is small, but the shriek and hubbub grows ever louder, the lying promises ever more audacious and cunning, uncontrolled and uncontrollable. Those who have nothing to lose, who do not want to think or analyze, follow the siren song of the seducer, which leads to ruin. Giddy with hunger, deafened by the tumult of the masses, driven by the longing for peace and freedom, they scream for that which they crave. The great scoundrel has reached his goal. Now he presses those who were deceived by his lies into a tortured mass, which he exploits and toys with. His sadism drives him to have a prison built next to his palace so that he can hear the chains rattle. The groaning and bleating of the prisoners is music to him. Now he has the power over life and death. And every day, while the mass hungers and suffers, a truck crosses the prison yard to his palace, laden with luxuries of food and drink. His tongue is strengthened with bonbons to tell sweet lies, which must remain unfulfilled. But slowly the folk realize that none of the promises have come true. Their awakening is strongly repressed, but the number of unbelievers grows swiftly. A whisper campaign begins. A plan is formed, a plan to cast down the deceiver. One day the truck is wrecked and the sweetmeats are spilled on the street for all the hungry to see. The signal is given. A few prisoners succeed in wrenching loose from their chains. Soon the guards are overpowered and the palace stormed. The mob rushes in, intent on vengeance. The object of their rage thinks quickly. He is far too cowardly to face the consequences of his misdeeds, and he flees through a secret tunnel to his prison. He changes his hair and beard just enough to deceive the casual glance. He cunningly chains himself to an iron ring and then cries to be freed. Upon his release, he storms ahead of the mob, screaming for the blood of the tyrant himself. He promises that he will free the people from their bondage, and again, no one notices his deception. He leads them on in search of himself, and jubilantly they follow the very one they wish to destroy. He mocks and reviles the cowardly tyrant who has flown from them. He puts a price on his own head and becomes a hero of the revolution. The folk willingly follow him and do not learn that they have been deceived. And he amuses himself before his expensive mirror, trying out new faces to deceive the folk. What shall he be this time? A reporter who earns money writing muckraking exposés of himself? Or perhaps a movie star? But no, he has a better plan. He becomes a holy man, a man of God. Fasting and praying, he lives in a hut in the woods, and the folk he betrayed, whom no earthly power can help, make the pilgrimage to him, the demigod. The ultimate victory is his. He can promise that which he cannot fulfill and be prayed to. That was After a War is Lost by George Kaiser, who was born in Magdeburg, Germany in 1878. He lived in Buenos Aires from 1898 to 1901. In 1921, he abandoned a career as a merchant to become a freelance writer. In 1933, his books were banned by the Nazis, and in 1938, he fled to Switzerland, where he died in 1945. Kevin Violette, who translated After the War is Lost, is a third-generation Oregonian of French-Canadian descent. He was raised in Garibaldi and worked for a number of years in his father's commercial fishing boat. He spent a year in Germany, and he taught German and Spanish. He is a member of the famous Astoria rock band, the Pagan Pancakes. And I would like to read a poem now by John Frederick Nims. Trick or treat. Holy and hokey, Halloween, that kindergarten of witches in the street, skeletons but with tummies, doorbell high, piping up, trick or treat, a hoyden by Goya with her Bruegel chum, scrabbles black orange jelly beans, then scoots, to think I saw you spangled so, rouged in your puss in boots. Some 40 and more years ago, memory, the reruns in full color seem as three-dimensional as now. Could it be now's the dream? We've been bewitched by spirited into this crinkled skin, this ashy hair, starch at the joints, this hand-me-down, raggedy gear we wear. We've dealt with clothes before, know well just what they hollow and how they fall away, strewing the floor in moonlight. Yes, into and past midday. Good costumes then. But now let's play. Pretend with those glittering infants at the door. Now that our autumns come and soon the snows arrive. Before, we're out of costumes and a place to play. Of zest for the zany carnival in the street. Out of breath, out of world and time. Teasing with trick or treat. And that was Trick or Treat by John Frederick Nims. And tomorrow is All Saints' Day. And among celebrated saints is Bridget Snow, who was born tomorrow, November 1st, 1898. She died at age 96 in May 1995. She splashed into the Pacific Ocean every New Year's Day at Arch Cape for more than 30 years until she was 90, and she wrote famous poems in the beach sand. Her granddaughter, Catherine Bridget Snow, was a program director early in KMUN's history. And I continue to think of Bridget, although we were not kin, but certainly kindred, as my last grandmother. Every morning when I finish my showers with a wake-up blast of cold water, which was Bridget's advice and training regimen for her annual plunges into the chilly ocean surf, I usually exclaim, "Good morning, Bridget," when I turn on the cold water. She was a 12-year-old pom-pom girl at Astoria's centennial celebration in 1911. This is Michael McCusker. Happy Halloween.